It is a great pleasure to have with us returning MOI Global instructors, Arvin Malik and Jonathan Feit, joining us here at Wide Moat Investing Summit 2022. Arvin and Jonathan are managing partners of KMF Investments, a pure pay-for-performance private investment partnership based in Denton, Texas. KMF seeks long-term capital appreciation by investing in companies whose intrinsic value is significantly higher than the market price. Since the firm's founding in 2008, KMF has found opportunities in world-dominating franchises, hard assets below replacement costs, businesses at large discounts to liquidation value, and firms with beneficial exposure to rising interest rates. And I have truly enjoyed your presentations in the past. I've always found them very compelling and certainly look forward to this one as well. I'd like to turn it to you guys now, and I'll be back at the end for the Q&A. Please go ahead.
John, thank you so much for the kind introduction. Jonathan and I are honored to be invited again to be part of this year's Wide Moat Summit. And of course, thank you also for building this great network of value investors from which we can learn so much from each other. And you know, given the market sell-off this year, we're excited to see what other ideas are going to be presented this year. We are presenting Spotify, which is a company whose product we, especially Jonathan and his family, have enjoyed for many years. But it was really an expensive tech growth stock. And during the recent sell-off, which has brought the stock down more than 70% from its highs, this growth stock has become more of a compelling value stock, and we believe it's actually a long-term compounder. Jonathan, if you can go to the next slide, please. Our presentation here is to inform and educate our value, fellow value investors and to encourage listeners to do their own research. Our investment partnership recently purchased shares of Spotify. We hope you find our presentation insightful. And we're definitely keen to hear back and get feedback from listeners. If we could move on to this next slide. As context, we wanted to give you and your listeners some background about our investment philosophy and strategy. We are long-term value investors inspired by Ben Graham, Warren Buffett, and many other great value investors. We're focused on finding good companies whose stock prices offer a margin of safety. But within that broad definition of value, we're actually able to be very nimble and flexible across industries, flavors of value, market caps, and even asset classes. We like to say that we go where the value is. And today, we're starting to see some value even in the tech growth space, given the sell-off, where we feel that the market has thrown out the baby with the bathwater. A few more words about our investment partnerships. We have a pure pay-for-performance structure inspired by the 1950s Buffett partnerships with zero management fee and only a profit-sharing structure with high watermarks. We also are quite transparent with our partners about valuation of our holdings, the overall portfolio, and the investment theses. This has helped create a patient and loyal base of partners that has allowed us to be contrarian during periods of market fear to find opportunities, whether it was during the 2008 financial crisis or more recently the 2020 COVID market crash, as well as the current market decline. Jonathan, if you could go to the next slide. We alluded to the different flavors of value investing, you know, many of which were pioneered by different value investors that we respect. We tend to group them into three rough buckets. The first, if you look at the left, is free cash flow-based valuations. Many of those include the wide moat type ideas that we'll, I'm sure, see many of during this conference. It includes high-quality buy and hold type companies, growth companies at a reasonable price, those which have a solvable incident, or what Mario Gabelli might label as private buyer value or strategic buyer value as well. The second category are asset-based valuations, where we're much more looking at the balance sheet, whether it's natural resource type companies and commodities, which we found a lot during the commodity downturn the last few years, whether it's trading below replacement cost, discount to book, Ben Graham net nets or spinoffs. And also finally, a third category being special situations, which include distressed debt and arbitrage opportunities, which were more plentiful during the financial crisis period, perhaps a bit less so now. Over the last 15 years, our fund has pursued a mix of these. During the financial crisis, we found a lot of high quality companies had come down to great prices and were very compelling, as well as many special situations, especially distressed debt and other credit opportunities during that credit crisis. During the last decade or so, though, we found that the broader market was really chasing growth and momentum. And during this time, we are focused much more on asset-based opportunities, including commodities, as well as quality type companies. The recent market environment has actually very strongly favored these asset and resource conversion plays, natural resource, and especially oil and gas. But we're seeing that the associated market sell-off in other areas is presenting growth at a reasonable price opportunities again. What we also see is that these different buckets of value investing opportunities really elicit different engagement models by us as investors. The free cash flow-based high-quality companies, especially the larger cap ones, our investments tend to be completely passive, where we, while analyzing operations and financials deeply, our contact with management is fairly passive. However, for smaller cap companies where we're able to build meaningful positions and also often get onto the boards through a friendly advisor type approach, we find ourselves much more active and advising companies on operations or capital allocation. So depending on the nature of the investment, our engagement style also differs. Jonathan, if we can hand off to the next slide.
Sure.
Let me hand off here to Jonathan to continue and dive deeper into our idea.
Great. Thanks, Arvind. John, after that framework review that Arvind outlined on kind of how we view the landscape of different value-based opportunities, we thought it might be good just to spend a minute acknowledging the current market context. I mean, as Arvind alluded to, for much of the last decade, adherence to value-based investing strategies have not really fared that well when compared to simply going long the S&P, or in particular, holding a basket of FANG stocks, you know, which buoyed much of the S&P index. In fact, you know, I think a lot of us kind of wondered what was happening as a number of famed value investors really made waves articulating their, you know, in air quotes here, value investment thesis on growth names like Netflix and Amazon and others. But, you know, with recent tech wreck, if you will, is notable. There are a lot of echoes to the 99-2000.com era. In fact, you know, Jeremy Grantham of GMO has been calling for this reckoning for a few years now. And I think really beginning since February of last year, February of 2021, we've started to see some real carnage in the tech space, and it's been incredibly severe. Now, there's a lot of names that we think deserved some of that carnage. I mean, there's so many names that were COVID beneficiaries that are now down 70, 80, 90%. We've seen those price declines. And, you know, we're still boggled how some EV companies, electrical vehicle companies that had no sales but a really good PowerPoint deck, you know, reached $100 billion market caps. But when we see this magnitude of decline across the sector, the contrarian side of us begins to beg the question if, you know, maybe there's some stuff that's overdone and maybe there might actually be some real value in there. And so we're going to spend some time talking about that today. You know, if we look at an overview of the broad markets and just kind of plot them on kind of a cheapness to performance ratio. And this is one of the simplest measures of cheapness, you know, looking at a real high level metric of PE as a measure of cheapness and then looking at returns. You know, we see that the major players in the index, the FANG companies and the other big tech stocks that have really buoyed the index over the last couple of years have really seen the largest declines so far this year. But even with those declines, you know, with using some of the most simple metrics of value, they still don't seem that cheap. And the only place to really hide so far this year has been in energy. And some other assets and kind of traditional value plays, but energy in particular has been a strong performer. And fortunately, this has been our biggest sector allocation over the last couple of years and continues to be our biggest sector allocation. And so this is really buoyed KMF this year. We fared pretty well in the context of the broader market carnage. But when we see some of these great businesses that we've admired for the last decade, but just have historically been at prices that we didn't feel comfortable buying at, when we see some of these great businesses fall 50, 60, 70%, you know, we start to ask, are these companies ones that might represent some real value, especially if you're willing to dig past the headline earning numbers and develop some differentiated insights. And so that brings us to our investment thesis today for Spotify. You know, Spotify is the number one audio streaming platform in the world. They currently have more than 400 million monthly active users, many of which benefit from Spotify's freemium model, kind of the free premium model blend where folks can try the service in an ad supported free way. But, and this creates a moderate ad business for Spotify. But with those 400 million plus kind of MAUs, there's also about 200 million paid subscribers spanning 183 markets around the globe. As the previous kind of bubble chart showed on the last page, even with the recent share price declines, you know, if we look at the kind of comparative EV to EBITDA metrics on the right-hand side of this page, even with the current decline, Spotify optically doesn't look that cheap using traditional valuation metrics like EV to EBITDA or PE multiples or other. But as we dig into the business, we're going to spend some time explaining not only why we think this is a wide moat business, this is a wide moat conference, and there's been a number of great businesses that have been presented over the years at the wide moat conferences for MOI. But oftentimes those companies come with valuations that are hard for dyed-in-the-wool value investors to get excited about. And we think that today Spotify represents an interesting wide moat opportunity at a really attractive entry point when you dig beyond the headline numbers. So let's kind of dig into a little bit more. As we see from the kind of recent price performance, it seems that a lot of investors associated Spotify as a COVID beneficiary, right? I mean, that stock tripled during the pandemic as lockdown orders and work from home scenarios really kind of increased the opportunities for on-demand streaming and audio listening. But you know, the recent price declines from almost $400 a share all the way down to below $100 a share have taken the stock back to pre-pandemic levels, even while the company has dramatically extended its lead over its rivals. I mean, if we look at the chart on the right, I know it's from late 2021, so the subscriber numbers represented in this page are a little bit lower than the headline numbers we showed on the previous page, but we still think the relative comparison is interesting and relevant to share. It's, you know, Apple, Google, really through their YouTube Music offering, Amazon Music. It's important to acknowledge these are well-funded competitors that do create threats to Spotify's moat. But Spotify has a huge lead in the number of paid subscribers, and somehow that lead continues to get larger year after year. So it begs the question, why? What is it about Spotify's business that allows them not only to be the number one player, but to continue to grow that lead over time? It's not just that they had a big head start and their growth is slowing while the big competitors finally show up with their massive wallets to eat Spotify's lunch. In fact, we see the opposite. With each year, the lead for Spotify continues to widen, and we think this is a really important indicator of their moat. Early on, we might have thought that their moat could be attributed to Spotify's technology advantage. I mean, they were the first to figure out instant on streaming, you know, no delay, no buffering, just click the button and music starts streaming. But eventually, this wasn't a unique enough value proposition, and everyone else copied that technology platform. But what we believe is the biggest driver of their competitive differentiation is their personalization engine. Spotify knows what you like based on what you listen to, and then Spotify introduces new music to you that you've never heard before, but somehow it thrills you. It knows what you like, and you discover all kinds of new artists that weren't in your historical CD collection. And in fact, Spotify does this not only by genre, but by mood or time of day. I mean, Spotify knows that you typically listen to something different on Saturday morning when you're cleaning the house versus on Thursday afternoon while you're working versus Friday night when you have everyone over for drinks. This personalization engine is really powerful, and Spotify's artificial intelligence and machine learning tools have assets that none of the other players have. Mainly dramatically more listeners to learn from, and then vastly more user-generated playlists. Spotify has over a billion playlists to help learn your preferred moods and genres and beats and acoustic styles. More than a billion playlists. Apple, the next largest competitor, has 30 million. I mean, it's more than an order of magnitude difference. And this is, it's just not even close. And this is a huge scale moat for Spotify, which is increasingly more difficult for others to catch up to. And because of those users and those playlists, both independent artists and the major labels are clamoring more and more to be in Spotify's curated playlists. This is a key driver for how streaming and Spotify in particular has saved the music industry. And so we want to just take a quick moment to step back and kind of talk about some of the industry context and how that's now a growth driver for Spotify. Many of you probably remember the music file sharing platforms of the late 90s and early 2000s, you know, things like Napster and Morpheus and Kazaa, you know, really with the digitization of music into easily transferable MP3 files, these pirate radio platforms really devastated the revenues and the profits of the music labels who historically controlled distribution. And while Apple's iPod, you know, they're 1,000 tunes in your pocket at 99 cents a pop, you know, that model helped slow the erosion a bit, but the industry was really just continued to be in a tailspin until music streaming finally reached some scale in kind of 2014, 2015 timeframe, which happens to coincide with Spotify's global adoption. And as we see, the industry overall is back in growth mode, even as the penetration rate of paid subscribers is still pretty low in comparison to global smartphone adoption. And so we think both industry growth, kind of the huge room to drive an incremental penetration on global smartphones, you know, these present some really interesting macro tailwinds for Spotify's growth going forward. And we can see how assumptions of higher penetration rates really aren't unreasonable given the entertainment value proposition. If we look at all various media types, music remains one of the cheapest sources of entertainment on a cost per hour consumption basis. And if you go back 20 years or more and look at this on kind of an inflation adjusted price of what we used to pay to consume music when we were buying tapes and buying CDs, right? We're still nowhere near the level that we of kind of spend consumption that we used to be, you know, 20, 25 years ago. So again, lots of room for music streaming to kind of continue to grow in the years to come. So let's talk about their monthly active users, right? This has been kind of the core story of the business. And while Spotify has about 420 million monthly active users today, the company's forecasting that they'll hit about a billion MAUs later this decade. And the chart on the left is a forecast from Deutsche Bank, and you know, their forecast pretty well mirrors, I think, and aligns to kind of company management projections over the next couple of years. But it's interesting to note that while the market treated Spotify like a huge COVID beneficiary, the growth has actually been pretty consistent, whether before COVID, during COVID, or really post-COVID reopening, the you know, the growth has been pretty steady, and we think there's a number of factors driving this. You know, new market expansions into new countries, greater penetration of new artists, driving a wider catalog of music and music appreciation, as well as the continued migration of their freemium offering to paid subscriptions. You know, if we look at the right-hand part of the slide, this is important because as people try the product in the ad-supported model and find that they really love it, the conversion rates from a free user to a paid subscriber have been pretty consistent over the last couple of years. And so as monthly active user rates climb towards a billion users, this will be a natural tailwind for paid subscriber growth, which is Spotify's largest revenue stream. But on top of this, Spotify is going to have an even larger ad-supported audience. And this is another key growth driver of the business. While the ad-supported freemium model exists, Spotify has historically under-monetized this user base. But over the last couple of years, the company has made a number of investments, both organically, but also significantly through some key M&A activities to build its ad stack monetization platform so that greater monetization of that free user base could be more realistic. So as both paid subscribers and ad monetization grows, the average revenue per user should continue to grow. Again, all tailwinds for revenues and margins over time. You know, and the next page really kind of supports this. If we see how the current ad supporter user base only generates a fraction of the revenue of versus Spotify's paid subscribers, we see that this is a significant opportunity for growth. Yet in relation to some other key ad supporter competitors, Spotify has tons of room to really monetize this cohort of listeners. You know, if we look at what they're kind of charging on a per user basis in relation to Pandora, if we look at kind of the margins associated with that, if you look at kind of what Facebook earns on a per user basis, you know, Facebook's earning $35 to $50 per user. YouTube earns about $9 per user. Spotify is currently only monetizing that free user base through ad monetization at maybe kind of a $3.5 to $4 per user rate. Again, just an intentional focus and capability building over the last couple of years has now enabled them to maybe go after this market a bit further and to see broader diversification of these revenue streams, interesting diversification and growth of revenue over time. So while Spotify is known or has been known as kind of a great tech developer and innovator for the streaming space, we want to spend a little bit of time on this in a minute, right? Because we think that's an important part of their artificial intelligence, machine learning, personalization engine. That's a huge part of the story and where their moat lies. But we also want to spend a minute on this page 13, which kind of shows the timeline of Spotify's major acquisitions over the last decade. It's clear that Spotify has been strengthening its platform to grow not only just standard audio music streaming, but a number of revenue streams from ad stack monetization to content personalization to podcast hosting and distribution. They've been really busy creating the platform or capabilities need to grow this business over the next decade. In addition, there have been a number of acquisitions to support Spotify's marketplaces business, which is now becoming an incremental and really an important contributor to their music business gross margin. For example, if an independent artist wants to sit in her bedroom and record her song and post it on TikTok, they can do that. But if they would prefer to have a professional producer and sound mixer and studio recording environment, Spotify now provides these services to their artists, right? And with independent artists representing an ever-growing mix of the available catalog, this is a meaningful growth driver to revenues and margins for Spotify over time. A few years ago, this marketplaces business represented about $20 million of contribution margin. Today, that's closer to $200 million, right? And this will continue to grow over time and is a significant driver of the music business continuing to improve its gross margins as we move forward. In addition, while most people consider the revenue and royalty share with the music labels as the big gross margin driver for Spotify, Spotify CEO Daniel Ek stated multiple times and really underscored this significantly at their recent investor day a couple of weeks ago, that this is not where the margin opportunity lies for Spotify. I mean, you could You could argue that given Spotify scale and the importance of Spotify in today's world of music distribution, that Spotify would have significant negotiating leverage to take a larger share of revenue in that royalty negotiation with the labels. But Daniel has stated that he wants to keep that revenue share relatively flat and instead drive higher margins through additional value-added services to the labels. For example, these production capabilities I just talked about through the marketplaces business, if that's being used by independent artists, that can also be used by the major record labels as well. And as Spotify's personalization engine creates new Discover Weekly playlists, Spotify users get exposed to new artists, and new artists find that being inserted in that one playlist for the first time gives them their big break. This is huge for independent artists and the traditional labels as well, since they're trying to optimize their own marketing, promotion, and distribution costs. They're willing to pay Spotify for inclusion in these curated playlists, right? They're increasingly paying for whether it's the Rap Caviar or the weekly playlist. These curated playlists, in addition to the file sharing of user generated playlists, is a huge growth opportunity as the labels and independent artists try to tap into that user base. So this isn't a great example of what we call the Charlie Munger win-win, right? Instead of, I think a lot of investors try to focus on where those label negotiations are going on, and instead of battling the labels on the royalty rate, which inevitably creates a win-lose for somebody, Eck is basically saying, let's just keep this status quo. Everything's good. Let's figure out how to create value for the labels, which is great for the artists. It's great for the labels, and it's hugely margin accretive for Spotify. The marketplace businesses is a huge component to why the music gross margins are growing over time. And quietly, the music business has been doing very well. The combined entity reporting historically has not been very good. Again, at the recent Investor Day, Spotify provided a lot of insight to how the music business is doing in relation to some of the other segments. And the core music business has quietly but significantly benefited from these acquired businesses over the last decade. And most of that noise around Spotify's financials has been attributed to the podcast capability and the talent acquisitions that we'll talk about in a minute. But over time, the gross margins for the core streaming business continue to improve, and they expect that to move from the mid-20s to the current level of the high 20s to kind of a mid-30s margin level over the next several years. And so, again, continued tailwinds for Spotify's growth. So let's talk about where Spotify's investments and some of the noise that's been surrounding the business for the last couple of years lies, and that's really around its content acquisition, right? Similar to what John Malone did with SiriusXM and what Reed Hastings did with Netflix, Spotify has been making really large investments in own content that attracts and scales across its growing user base. In the mid-2000s, when Howard Stern got his huge deal to go to satellite radio, everyone thought that that deal was nuts, but this created a massive migration of Stern listeners to the satellite radio platform, which created scale for Sirius. And, that content investment, created a huge user base to spread those investments across. Netflix did the same thing when they moved from just licensing other people's content to, producing their own. And then some would probably argue today that Netflix went too far down that model, greenlighting basically anything that walked and could fog a mirror. But we still think the core analogy of acquiring significant owned IP and content to attract and scale a user base is an appropriate analogy. And, most notably their deal with Joe Rogan, which has kind of proved controversial given some of Rogan's comments in the COVID era, it's probably the most famous significant deal in the podcasting arena. If we dig into some of these details related to the Rogan podcast, what we find is that it's still the number one program across 93 markets. And in many markets, the Joe Rogan Experience was the most listened to show every month. This drives both user acquisition and subscriber adoption to the platform with a really engaged audience, which is great for subscription conversion and ad monetization. In fact, Rogan's listeners return to Spotify more than any other user segment on the platform, and they listen to more content than any other user on the platform, which has all been critical to making Spotify the top US podcasting platform. You know, this is great, again, for both subscription growth and ad monetization. And we believe this helps create kind of a beneficial network effect, right? We talked a little bit about their scale mode. Now we're talking about an incremental mode around a network effect, because as more users flock to this content, more content creators, more artists want to bring their content to that targeted and unique user base. And then perhaps more importantly, we now have a growing ad stack that is available to marketers who want to access a very well understood demographic in a marketing ad stack in an era where Apple's privacy policies have really impaired a lot of the ad targeting capabilities of other platforms like Facebook and Snapchat. So that's a little bit of the context. We thought, as value investors, let's spend a little bit of time looking at maybe some of the financial profile of the business, because as we kind of kick things off with earlier, we think some of the headline numbers are a little bit misleading, and it requires a little bit of digging under the surface to better understand the business. So our thesis is that Spotify's personalization engine has really created a moat that attracts both users and artists to the platform. And this, combined with their creator tools and their marketplace segment, has created a really strong music streaming franchise that's going to grow margins over the next couple of years. In fact, I kind of referenced this earlier at their investor day a couple of weeks ago. They talked about how over the last 5 years, they've steadily grown the music business margins from the mid 20s to the high 20s. And they expect that to land in kind of the mid 30s gross margin levels over the next decade or so, or by the end of the decade. And so this core strong music business has enabled Spotify to fund these acquisitions to grow new revenue streams. It's enabled it to grow into the leader for podcasting, where it has a huge subscriber and ad monetization growth runway in front of itself. And that business is really now just starting to get to scale, right? I think one of the reasons why the stock has sold off over the last 6 to 9 months, right, is those investments in the podcasting side of the business have dragged down margins even further, and everyone's kind of worried about rising rates, and anything associated with tech has sold off. But that ad platform, ad monetization business tied to the podcasting side of the house is now starting to reach enough scale that it can contribute to the overall business. You know, in the investor day, they outlined how the learnings from growing the second major business line around podcasting has revealed some learnings on how they can scale across other business lines, right? Music is the core. They've spent the last 3 or 4 years building podcasting, and it's just now going to start contributing at scale to the business. But those learnings have taught Spotify how it can maybe enter in some new verticals, namely around audiobooks, you know, where Amazon's kind of audiobook business had really innovated a lot over the last 20 years. I mean, it's an interesting platform, number one leader, but there hadn't been a lot of innovation there. Spotify thinks that it can take share and improve the margins of that business, as well as the broad audio education market, right? So a couple of new verticals that might provide some interesting growth. But across all of these segments, what we find is that most of all of these investments are being made through the income statement, you know, which occludes the profitability and the traditional value metrics of the business. For instance, if we look at their research and development costs, most all of this is likely some form of what value investors would consider growth CapEx. But since it's spent, that spend is classified on the R&D line, you know, it runs through the income statement, burdening earnings, burdening, you know, EV to EBITDA metrics, rather than, you know, below the line kind of assessments if you were to look at if it was a growth CapEx investments on the cash flow statement. Similarly, if you look at kind of their marketing and sales expenses, we think that a good portion of those costs are being targeted at growing their user base, but that's flowing, that growth investment is flowing through the income statement. So we prefer to view Spotify by getting an adjusted view of its profitability to see what this business might be worth if they pared back or suspended some of their growth investments, right? What is this kind of adjusted standstill free cash flow view of the business? what is this core business worth, right? Because we think it's got a good scale mode, and what would that be if it didn't grow in the future? And importantly, if we get this kind of standstill free cash flow view, we can then begin to assess and measure how effective these growth investments in the income statements are. What kind of returns are they generated from those investments? So if you look at the right-hand side of this page, page 16, and take a closer look at their 2021 year-end financials, what we've done is we've backed out the R&D expenses, and we've taken a simple 20% swag of their sales and marketing expenses. You know, we think in reality that a larger percentage of this marketing spend is probably targeted to growth, but we're just going to assume 20% for now to kind of try to be conservative and keep things simple. Once we adjust for kind of the current euro dollar exchange rate and apply a simple 10x multiple, saying that, hey, what is a no growth business worth? It's probably worth that if it has a moat and it doesn't grow, it's probably worth 10 times, you know, free cash flow. And so a 10x multiple to that, kind of cash adjusted, we see that the no growth price of the business is roughly about $100 a share. Interesting. You know, so at roughly $100 a share, you're getting all future growth in the company for free. And the stock has recently traded below these levels and today trades maybe slightly above it. So it seems to us, the market just doesn't believe that all of those things that we talked about, that none of those growth opportunities are going to materialize, or if they do grow, there's really not going to be any profitable growth ahead for Spotify in the years ahead. And at KMF, we're taking the other side of that bet. You know, who knows what's going to happen in the market over the next couple of months, but over the next couple of years, we believe there are just too many growth drivers to ignore for Spotify, whether it's their continued march higher of monthly average users, you know, and that MAU stack converts into paid subscribers, or their ad stack actually gets monetized at a more realistic level, or the growth of their marketplaces businesses, or their mix shift to more independent artists where they get a higher rake, or their value-added services for artists and creators and labels, not to mention, you know, new verticals like audiobooks and education. Some of those things are probably going to hit. And so buying this business at a no growth price seems like a really interesting opportunity for us. So as I've said, we think this is a pretty interesting opportunity, kind of buying it at what we think is a no growth price, but with tons of upside optionality. The question logically becomes, well, how much upside is there in this business? So page 17 in the deck kind of takes a stab at summarizing what we think Spotify could be worth in a few years. You know, over the last several years, if you look at that standstill free cash flow view, Spotify has basically reinvested about 75% of their standstill free cash flow. You know, said another way, if you look at those R&D and sales and marketing expenses that are driving growth, those expenses have been about 75% of the cash generated before those investments. That's a pretty high reinvestment rate. And if you look at the resulting growth in the standstill free cash flow year after year, you know, if I invest 75% back in the business, hopefully I get some growth out of that. Well, that 75% reinvestment rate has typically generated returns in the 35 to 45% range. Pretty good returns, right? And so if you believe Spotify can continue to reinvest at those rates with those types of returns, the stock's a multi-bagger over the next couple of years, right? And you can kind of do your own assumptions for how good the investments in podcasts are going to turn out and, you know, what kind of growth audiobooks or education markets might bring, or how much margin contribution the marketplace business has. But, you know, we think just over the next 4 or 5 years, you know, again, the longer you hold this thing, the better it becomes. You know, this is one of those maybe never sell type of companies. You could easily earn multiples of your invested capital. And, you know, if you take the flip side and say, well, what does the current market price imply? Well, it basically implies that their reinvestment rates decline pretty dramatically, and the returns on those reinvestments kind of converge to maybe kind of a 10, 15% cost of capital. And, you know, we just think that there's too many growth drivers for the current price to be reflective of the value of the business in the coming years. And so maybe what's interesting is this is kind of our view, right? Just using a simple kind of return on invested capital reinvestment rate kind of analysis. But at the recent investor day, Daniel Ek made some interesting comments, right? Said that over the next 8 to 9 years, right, basically by the end of the decade, they want the business to be a $100 billion business with 20% operating margins. Maybe they get there. Maybe it takes a little longer than he thinks. But Spotify is a $19 billion market cap business, right? Again, even if just a few things go okay, we think Spotify presents a really amazing value in today's tech rec. So I'm going to stop rambling on from there. Arvin, let me kind of pull you back in and see if there's any kind of additional commentary you want to add to the valuation side before we move on to some of the balance sheet and another commentary.
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. I think you covered it thoroughly. The comment you just said about the long-term guidance that was given in the recent investor day, just to add a little bit to that, the 100 billion with 20% operating margins, and in between there's a 40% gross margin. So both gross margin growth leading to the operating margin growth. So trading at 1x that long-term operating profit, should the company actually achieve that, would definitely result in a multi-bagger, Jonathan is describing. Clearly there's you see in the slide here is more of a compounding view of how they get there. And clearly Daniel Ek sees that as they steadily invest away in this growth and add different verticals, such as growing podcasting and inflecting that towards profits and then adding audiobooks and so forth. That's the runway to growth for their very ambitious aspiration of growing almost eightfold over the decade. If you could go on, John. Thanks. This slide is just depicting, in addition to the valuation-based downside protection or margin of safety, the very strong balance sheet that Spotify has makes it quite resilient during the current market downturn. The company has a lot more cash than debt and actually is free cash flow positive, even though it does not have accounting positive earnings because of the investments and other factors. It does have a negative working capital business model, which is very attractive. So as it grows, because it's cash flow, incoming cash flows from subscribers comes in before the outflows, growth is actually accretive to free cash flow and adds to the margin of safety. Also, what is noteworthy is that on the liability side, the company has about $1.2 billion of what are called exchangeable notes. And it's quite interesting that these are actually zero coupon bonds that the company issued when the stock price was very high. So they're really a form of convertible debt when the company's stock price was much, much higher than current and should really be viewed more as quasi-equity than even as debt, even though they are due in a few years. So between those, all in all, the company has a very liquid and solid balance sheet to navigate the current environment. If you could move on, Jonathan. Jonathan's described the company's business model and moat quite well, so I won't delve into it. The marketplace, of course, the stock market, by the stock price itself implies that they don't necessarily believe as much in the moat. But as Jonathan has talked about, the fact that Spotify has grown and fended off tough competition and has not only maintained but actually grown its market share, and also as revealed in the recent investor day, its gross margins in the music streaming business have actually grown. All these are indicators that of strong management, but also of a strong scale, brand, and network effect moat. And as the recommendation engine descriptions Jonathan provided, we also believe that there is a meaningful switching cost moat, even if there isn't really necessarily a strong intellectual property or licensing moat. If we go on, Jonathan, we've talked a fair bit about the evolution of the company, and the moat really While the company started off with, you know, a very high caliber software capability, which amazed the marketplace with the instant playback, over time the fulcrum of the moat has really moved to the curated playlists, artificial intelligence based capabilities on the playlist, which we've talked a fair bit about, and the brand affinity and recommendation engine, which we believe is a more sustainable moat that isn't purely driven by innovation, but actually uses the existing scale of 400 plus million users and drives penetration among those users and beyond, and almost becomes more of a social network in its own right. If we could move on, Jonathan. Management is another big strength of Spotify's. The CEO and founder, Daniel Ek, owns more than $1 billion worth of shares. Actually, one thing that really caught our eye just last month is he purchased more than $50 million of Spotify stock in the open market, not far from the current stock price, which we see is one of the strongest insider buys that we've really seen of any company recently. So that definitely shows that he is putting his money where his mouth is, and you know, clearly views the stock as undervalued at this current levels. If we keep moving here, Jonathan, when we invest in KMF, you know, as value investors, we are very much focused on intrinsic value and buying at a margin of safety to that intrinsic value. What we've often found is that often there are catalysts or events that help drive the stock price and unlock value to help it approach intrinsic value. And we tend to put those catalysts into three types of buckets: operational, which is management rolling up their sleeves to achieve profitable growth. On occasion, as I've mentioned, for many of our portfolio companies, we often get quite hands-on, whether through participation with the board or as friendly advisors, to help them in that regard. And there often are financial catalysts, such as stock buybacks, debt placements, asset sales, and other means to unlock value. And actually, Spotify has been fairly astute, we've seen, in terms of their awareness of intrinsic value and lifetime value of their user base. They seem quite thoughtful about how to look at their business from a lifetime value of customers. And also the debt placement that I pointed to, issuing convertible debt when the stock was very richly valued during 2021. And by the same token, when the stock has fallen 70%, for Daniel Ek to then see the stock as a bargain and actually buy shares himself shows quite an astute view of the company has of its financial position and valuation. Among the operational catalysts, just to fine tune that, what was also noteworthy in the recent investor day was Daniel Ek and the management team, which has quite a good bench, pointing to inflections that are likely in the next year or year and a half on the podcast business, where they move much more from investment mode into monetization mode and expecting an inflection in gross margins and operating margins in that division in the next year and a half or so. So that should be a good operational catalyst as well. Finally, on the macro side, it's noteworthy that the Spotify has actually grown into more than 180 markets and already dominates not only in developing markets, which is where much of the free cash flow and revenue really comes from, but is really a top player in many, many emerging markets, whether India or the Philippines, among many others. And as those emerging markets grow and average revenue per user in those markets, as the middle classes of those nations grow, should be a nice tailwind for Spotify as well. And also several analysts and the management team themselves acknowledge that there's also quite a bit of latent pricing power in the business, which they've chosen not to monetize. That should come into play in coming years as well. If we move to the next slide, John. On this slide, we just like to summarize the investment thesis. We like the manual of ideas investment checklist that John, you often use in some of your publications. We find that Spotify does check most of these MOI type biz investment criteria. The stock is a compelling value, with the price having declined 70% from its highs to what we see as a no growth price, where the optionality of growth provides healthy upside. A strong balance sheet and liquidity position and positive free cash flow from a capital efficient business model provides good safety. We've talked quite a bit about the moat from brand, network effect, switching costs. We've talked a little bit about management. Eck has shown a really strong record as a founder, owner, operator, and now also showing strong alignment by putting his money through this recent $50 million insider buy. The company has a healthy capitalization and balance sheet. Performance-wise, the underlying business has continued to perform very well. You've seen the steady rise in monthly active users. Recent controversy around the Joe Rogan podcast, plus the overall tech wreck, has led to the shares trading at depressed levels. And we do see many catalysts, including macro, from the ad shift, the turnaround in the podcasting profitability and others that might unlock value. We do see Spotify shares having substantial upside potential as a compounder over the coming years. John, we'd like to wrap up. We have given our email address on this page, and we're eager to hear back from listeners and engage with your community, which comprises many value investors that we respect. So we're keen to engage with yourself and your audience.
Terrific. Well, Jonathan and Arvind, thank you so much for the compelling presentation on a name that everyone knows, but I think not everyone has looked at in as much detail. Maybe just a general question to start, because in the past you've also presented companies that trade at, let's say deep value multiples of EV to EBITDA. How do you guys kind of weigh the cheapness versus the business quality? I guess in this case, the business quality is just so compelling, but I'd love to understand a little bit the process of kind of, how do you decide to go for this investment versus something that's maybe at, 6x EBITDA, but doesn't have quite the outlook?
I think that's and I'll have Arvind join us as well. I think that's a little bit of the art to this, right? I mean, I think when we began this as Buffett devotees, right, it was all about how do I find a Coca-Cola trading at 10 or 12 times and let me buy it and never sell it. And, the simplistic, let me just go buy some Ben Graham net nets, because you don't have to do much thinking on those, right? You just keep screening for something that's maybe not a biopharma stock that's in 9 months and buy a basket and move on. And as you kind of do more of this, you appreciate more and more what Charlie taught Warren, which is great businesses are the best things to own. And, I think the last decade, many value managers lagged, right? Just because it was hard for us in particular to fathom how good a business Facebook and Google. I mean, you just, when you're running a valuation model, you don't expect businesses to quintuple earnings, right? Or to see, revenues quintuple and earnings go up 20x over a decade. And yet we saw some of these businesses that had truly special business models do that. And so we don't want to fight yesterday's war, but when we've looked at these, we've looked at the FANG stocks for 5, 6, 7 years, and we have, Google's another major, or Alphabet's another major position of ours, because we think of the other kind of FANG plays, we still think it has probably some of the best differentiation and differentiated business model, and again, long-term growth at a reasonable price. But so many of these other great businesses were just too expensive for our appreciation of the business to also resonate with our just dyed-in-the-wood wool view of value. And so in the 2015 to kind of 2020 period, we found a lot of hard asset plays, you know, whether it was in the shipping arena where, you know, there had been so much overbuilding in that arena in the late 2000s and early 2020 teens that, you know, company after company was going bankrupt. And so when you see carnage in an industry, the contrarian us goes, well, let's go dig into that pile of rubble and see if there's anything worth buying, right? And or the energy space that was so unloved with the evolution of ESG models. And so for the last 4 or 5 years, that's probably been where the bulk of our attention has been, John, is in the lower multiple kind of asset replacement view that would benefit from a kind of macro tailwind of rising rates, rising inflation, rising demand of energy, those types of things. But the last year in particular, really since, you know, Cathie Wood's ARC fund kind of peaked out in February 2021, and you saw all of these companies that just had no business having any kind of valuations that they had completely implode, you know, very much akin to where Jeremy Grantham was talking about, you know, companies being taken out to the woodshed and shot. You know, we avoided a lot of that, but in that sell-off where we think a lot of that sell-off was warranted, you know, Amazon down 33% is interesting. Google down 33% is interesting. You know, even Tesla down, I mean, we still wouldn't buy Tesla today, but Tesla down 40% is interesting. Spotify down 70% just was too compelling to us. And so while we're actually beginning to trim some of our energy exposure, while we're beginning to trim some of our kind of exposure to some of the other hard asset plays like shipping and those types of things, because those have run up so much over the last year, we still think energy is a core ballast to our portfolio. We think there's more upside risk to oil prices than dramatic downside risk. We still think it's prudent, you know, when everyone's on one side of the boat, we want to kind of move to the other side. And so when everyone was avoiding energy like the plague, that was a great time to be playing in distressed debt and convertible debt of, or, you know, some of the equities, post-bankrupt equities of energy companies. And today, when you see companies down 70, 80, 90% that have great business models, we think that's a great place to allocate capital. And so I wouldn't say we do one or the other. We just, I don't know, I always wore the old Ocean Pacific shorts after they were 5 years out of fashion. I tend to kind of do everything that everyone else thinks is unpopular when they leave it. But from an investment perspective, I think that that works out okay. So Arvind, why don't you jump in there with your view of the world?
Yeah, I think you covered it well, Jonathan. And it's to us, John, some of this is about sizing and balance of the portfolio as well. So, you know, while the energy and commodities part of the portfolio has run up, we are somewhat rebalancing towards the high quality part of the portfolio as well. We'd rather not have everything just purely be deep value, but also have in a balance into the higher quality at reasonable price, growth at reasonable price, and a small amount of special situations in the portfolio as well.
Terrific. Well, maybe in the interest of time, just one more question from me. You talked about, you know, how audio is actually quite cheap for what it offers. How do you think about the ARPU, if you will, that Spotify could get to over the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, it's, I think that's one of the key metrics to track. But I think everyone spends a lot of time focusing on one or two very simplistic metrics and not looking enough at some of the underlying things that are more important. So for instance, just, I mean, you can get the total revenue for the company, look at MAUs, look at subscriber MAUs and track that. And if you look at what other companies, whether it was Facebook historically or Google through YouTube or others, you look at what kind of free business models that are just ad supported, kind of how they're able to monetize users. There are other companies that have ARPUs that are multiples of Spotify's, right? And so on the ad supported business, we think there is huge runway, right? And I think that really kind of points to, they were using the profitability to acquire and build the ad monetization capability, right? It is, they've historically really relied on that paid subscriber model. And we'll talk about that in a minute. We think there's some ARPU revenue growth there as well. But I think there's huge ARPU growth on the ad monetization side for the free users, especially with the personalization engines marketers can attack, right? One of the reasons Facebook is down by 50, 60%, right, is their ability to do kind of targeted ad has been impaired. And they're investing significantly, not only in their Meta platform, but in trying to stop using the aggregation that they got off of your iPhone or your Android platform to kind of figure out what you like and target ad to you. Now we can't do that. So they're trying to use AI engines to figure that out in a slightly more amorphous way. And Facebook was probably going to have enough resources to do that, but that's really impacted their business in the near term. Spotify has a tremendous amount of data because they know what you listen to. They know what podcasts you listen to, but they don't have to look at what you're looking at other apps to really get some interesting demographic data on you, which is going to be really important to ad marketers. And so the fact that they've under monetized that historically, and they've got some really interesting capabilities to deliver into that space going forward, we think that's a huge driver for ARPU growth there. And then on the traditional kind of paid subscriber side, Arvind mentioned, we think that there's still some pricing power there. We think like Amazon Prime or others that, you know, a dollar or two a month of an incremental price increase. I mean, Netflix, I think, has tried to test that elasticity a little bit, but we believe that there's some meaningful price elasticity where they could move some price increases for the premium model. And then just what they get on the back end, whether it's top line revenue from the users, but then also these marketplace businesses and the kind of net royalty rates that they get after kind of the value add services to the labels. That ARPU growth can happen in a lot of different facets rather than just, you know, is John being charged more per month? You know, it's what they might take to provide some of those services to the independent artists to be included in that Discover Weekly playlist, right? Or there's so many different vectors that ARPU growth can happen other than just let me raise the price to you as the user. And so we think it's pretty meaningful. But again, that's where X says, hey, there's these other vertical lines of business that we'll go into. We think gross margins will go from the mid 20s up to 40 as a company, because he believes, you know, while music may kind of level out at a 35% kind of contribution margin rate, you know, he thinks the podcast may be in the 40 to 50% range. He thinks audiobooks are going to be closer to 40. Education may be meaningful, right? And so these other lines of business, once they achieve scale, he believes are more profitable. And so there's lots of drivers to that quote unquote ARPU as we drive towards a billion active, you know, by the end of the decade. Arvind?
Yes. You know, all very important points. One of the insights that the Spotify management team gave during the recent investor day that was quite thoughtful was this balancing act between the ARPU, which has multiple dimensions across regions, and also churn. One of the things that was very noteworthy is that the company's churn has come way down. As markets mature, the actual user churn and attrition goes down a lot. And once that happens, then that's when the company often starts exercising some pricing power. What's been dilutive to ARPU the last few years is their massive growth in penetrating new emerging markets where the average rates are much, much lower. So that's brought down the ARPU on a aggregated average basis, but on a market by market basis, they have experimented with raising rates and they've been able to do so without hurting their churn rate or attrition of users. So that's been pretty meaningful. They're quite thoughtful about that. They one of the segments in the investor day was devoted to customer lifetime value, which is what they're ultimately trying to optimize, where they look at the marketing investments to obtain a customer, and also how they optimize that, the value of that customer, through various offerings, so, you know, whether it's continuing as subscribers or upselling them into some sort of podcast or audiobook over time. So
we're charging them
optimizing more. And charging them more as well. Yeah. So there's, it's not just about the rate per month, but also what other, you know, the overall ROI on that customer.
Okay, terrific. Well, I want to thank both of you so much for joining us again this year, and would just encourage our members to feel free to reach out and follow up with any further thoughts or questions. Always a pleasure to have you. Thanks.
Thank you very much, John.
Goodbye for now.